You're listening to the Vertical Access Podcast. VA is the college-age community of High Street Baptist Church in Springfield, Missouri. For more information, go to highstreet.org.
So tonight, we are starting a brand new series called called Big Questions. And what we're going to be doing in this series is we're going to be taking a look at five questions that are difficult questions to answer for someone who is a follower of Jesus Christ, or for someone who would say, I'm a person who has deep faith, or I'm a religious person, or maybe even tonight, if you're not a religious person. These are questions that are very difficult to face and swallow if you're looking to take a journey down what Christianity may be about. And tonight, the very first question that we're going to look at is, can there really be one true religion? Can there really be one true religion? But before we get into that, let me kind of tell you what I want, my expectations for this series are, okay? Because I don't want to let you down. So let's reevaluate our expectations. There's one thing I can guarantee you tonight. I'm not going to be able to answer that question for you, right? Like, some of you are like, why the heck did I come? Like, you just said we're doing this whole thing about these questions. You can't even answer it. But here's what I am going to say. What we're going to do tonight is going to be a discussion starter and hopefully a propellant for you in your faith journey. Wherever that may be, whatever that may look like, I'm hoping that what we talk about tonight pushes you forward in facing and dealing with these questions that we've got to answer in life, that we've got to wrap our minds around at some level. You know, the reality is, for each of these questions, entire libraries have been written to answer them. And so it's kind of crazy for me to think I can take in 30 minutes or 35 minutes or 40 minutes, just kidding, 35 minutes. It's crazy to think that I can, in 35 minutes, give you a perfect answer to all these questions when people have devoted their lives to writing books and books and books trying to address these things. But here's what I want to do. Okay, with all the research, the study I've done for this message and in the past years as I've gone through school, my hope is what I'm trying to do is boil down each question to the single most impactful or powerful answer I can find. So I'm saying, here's all these books and everything they have to say. I think the number one biggest takeaway for this question is what we're going to talk about tonight. And so we're going to dive into maybe one thing. So I'm not going to overload you with information and say, let's talk about 100 different ways to answer this one question. I'm going to simply start the discussion, start the dialogue for you, wherever you're at, wherever you're going, with what I think is the most powerful answer to that question, or one of the most powerful answers. And so tonight, let's begin with this. Let's talk about for a moment doubts. Now, doubts are a very real part of all of our lives. You know, have you ever been in a situation, or maybe you know what this feels like, where you've got some very real doubts in your life, and it's kind of disturbing, isn't it? Like, you know what you mean. Like, guys, how many times have you been here where you saw that girl, and you wanted to ask her out, you wanted to go talk to her, but you had your doubts, right? Anybody want to confess to being in that position before? Okay, two or three, four. Okay, look, some honest young gentlemen here. Ladies, take note of the ones that aren't liars. And you're like, man, I like you, but I've got doubts. If you like me back, because I look at you, then I look at me, and you're here, and I'm there, and I've got my doubts. Or there's another time, you know, maybe when you're deciding what school to go to for college or what major to declare, right? You've got your doubts. And I know this is true because I've talked to many of you about, Brian, I'm like 3 classes left in 1 semester, but now I'm questioning what I'm going to do with my entire life, and I'm kind of having a breakdown. I've got my doubts about what anyone ever been there before. All right, good. A few more honest people. And last but not least, and this one hits home a little more for me. You know, one of the times where people doubt the most or have the most doubts they've got to face in life is when they're talking or thinking about getting married. Now, I don't know about you, but when I was talking to my lovely wife, Sarah, who's in the back, about getting married, I had some doubts I had to process through. Now, it's not because there's anything wrong with Sarah, but I mean, it's a big decision, right? Like, I am saying I want to commit the rest of my life till death do me part to you. Now, that should make you a little nervous tonight, because that's a big deal. And so let's talk about it. So when I was going to propose to Sarah, I had some doubts that I was kind of wrestling with and trying to think through. And so I went to my friends, and I went to my dad, and I went to my pastor, and I went to some other people who love the Lord and love me and love Sarah. And they all said the very same thing. Brian, she is the greatest woman you could ever find. You're insane if you don't try to nail this down now, right? Like, if why are you having doubts, right? Like, she should be doubting. You should be crystal clear on this one, Brian. And so after I heard that enough times and built my self-esteem back up, I realized this is what we need to do, okay? But here's a true story, okay? So I proposed to Sarah. We are on like cloud nine. It's awesome. We're all giddy. She's starting to stress out planning for the wedding, and it's exciting time. And so I proposed to her right before Christmas, but then we go to Christmas break, and she moves back into her house to go back to school the next spring break, our next spring semester. And one of her best friends was a roommate. And this roommate just never really liked me from the very beginning, all right? So guys, if a roommate doesn't like you, there's still hope for you, okay? But for whatever reason, she just... And you know what? I was kind of a tool when she first met me, so I can't blame her, all right? But she never really liked me. And so she sat Sarah down. She said, "Sarah, I'll be honest with you. I've got some real concerns about you and Brian. And she just flat out told her, "I don't think y'all should get married." Now, okay, put yourself in Sarah's shoes, okay? The guy that you're just so excited to spend the rest of your life with is, you know, y'all are just so like, "Ah, this is awesome. We're getting married. So fun. I'm going to look at dresses. It's so exciting." And then your best friend sits you down and says, "You're making a mistake." All right. And all of a sudden, there's some real doubts. So then Sarah comes and relays this information to me. And after the steam went away from my head and my natural color returned to my face, we talked about this. Now, we had two options in this moment. Two. There we go. Two options. Option one is we could have neglected the doubt. Because now there's some very real doubts we were struggling with. We could have neglected and kind of naively went into marriage hoping for the best. We could have just kind of pushed them aside, "Well, what does she know? Let's just forget about it," and kind of gladly move forward hoping for the best in life. Or, and this is the second option, this is what we did, we could have embraced those doubts, faced those doubts, and kind of struggled through if there's any merit to what she has to say. And so this is what we did, and I'll tell you, it was not fun, right? It's not fun to sit down with the girl that you said, "I want to spend the rest of my life with you. Should we be spending the rest of our life together?" Like, that's not a fun process, but we did that. And we stared down some of these concerns, fears, worries, doubts. And through this entire process, through prayer and processing and struggling through it and getting good counsel in our life, we came through. And when we came through this period of struggle, we were even more convinced that we needed to be married. Right? So we went through this fire, and the fire didn't burn the whole house to the ground. It just refined us. And after we made it through, our love for each other was even more committed. And the incredible thing is, to this day, if you ask either of us, we'll say, "You know what? That was one of the best things that could have happened to us." Because after it was said and done, we were so much more convinced that we needed to move forward and that we should be getting married after that. So here's the thing about doubts. This is the model that I want to apply to you. Because if you're tonight, if you're breathing, if you're alive, if you're a human and you're alive, you've got your own doubts about faith. You've got your own doubts about God. And so I want to encourage you to do two things tonight. Tonight, if you're a believer, okay, you say, "I identify myself as a follower of Jesus Christ. I'm a Christian." My challenge to you is to not neglect, to not push to the side, not sweep under the rug, but to embrace your doubts, to face them down, to struggle with them, to look into that scary question that you don't really like looking into, but I just kind of push it to the side, and every once in a while it comes up, but then I just kind of forget about it and move on. Okay, don't neglect it. Don't push aside. I want you to embrace that doubt, embrace the struggle, and evaluate your faith. Evaluate objectively why you believe what you believe, why you're giving your life to what you're giving your life to. The reason why is because if you neglect, and if you push those doubts to the side, this is what's going to happen. Eventually, life is going to catch up with you, and it's going to get hard. And the circumstances of your life are going to become so great that those doubts will come back out of the closet, out from underneath the rug, and then they will destroy your faith. Right? If you've got doubts about how God could be good but allow suffering, when you're going through suffering, those doubts will compile and make things even worse. But if before you enter into a season of suffering, you embrace those doubts and you struggle with those doubts, once you hit that season of suffering, you will be able to persevere because your faith will have already been refined. And so if you're a believer tonight, don't run away. Don't neglect. Embrace the doubts. Now tonight, maybe you wouldn't identify yourself as a Christian. You say, "Brian, I'm more of the skeptic. I'm more of the unbeliever. I'm more of the one who's, I'm going to be a little more objective about this. I'm not just going to take a hook, line, and sinker. I'm going to really process and think about it." Okay, my challenge to you is this. My encouragement and my invitation for you is this. I want you to look for the faith that lies within the reasoning behind your doubts. Because tonight, you've probably got some good reasons to doubt Christianity, if I'm just going to be really honest. Okay, this Bible, why do we know it's true? How can we trust it? Hasn't science disproved all this kind of antiquated stuff anyways? And like we're going to talk about tonight, how can we really know that there's one true religion? So here's what I want you to do, to evaluate your doubt, evaluate your skepticism, because I think what you'll find is what lies underneath that doubt and that skepticism is in within the reasoning of that doubt, you will find faith. So my encouragement to you is to doubt your doubts. And let me give you an example if you're not tracking with me, okay? Let's just take this example right here. Brian, tonight, I'm not a Christian, and I doubt that there is one true religion. And the reason why I doubt that, my reasoning that has brought me to this doubt is fundamentally, I think all religions are asking the same questions. And when I look at all these religions that they're asking the same questions, they all seem to be coming up with pretty similar answers. Be a good person, be honest, love people, be giving, don't be self-centered, be selfless. And so if all religions are basically asking the same questions and all of the answers they seem to be coming up with are pretty similar, therefore, it makes more sense in my mind that all religions are equal and all religions are on the same playing field. So as soon as I hear someone talking about the superiority of Christianity or one faith is greater than the other, I kind of like, whoa, 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 I don't know if that's for me. Okay, but let's think about this for a second. Okay, so doubt your doubts. Look for the faith within your doubts, within the reasoning of your doubts. Okay, that's built on this idea that, number one, you have to realize, for those two questions, you can't scientifically prove, there's no empirical reasoning that could ever bring you to the point where you could say, you know what, every religion basically answers all these questions the same way. And on top of that, it's not a universally held belief. So those two statements, that reasoning that's brought you to that conclusion is in and of itself a leap of faith. Right? Because it's not universally held that all religions are asking the same question. So it's not a self-evident truth. And on top of that, we can't prove, there's no empirical data to back up the idea that all religions answer these questions the same way. And so I just say that as a little illustration to show you, we need to be in the practice of doubting our doubts and embracing our doubts. So if you're a believer, don't deny, don't neglect, face them, struggle with them. If you're a skeptic or you're not a believer tonight, evaluate why you think what you think, the reasoning that's brought you to that, and maybe, just maybe, there's more religious belief in there than you first thought. Okay, so let me address this question now. Let's move into this question right here. Can there really be one true religion? Okay, let me explain to you why this is such a big deal. Okay, how many of you have a grandma, and you've got like a funny name for your grandma? One. All right. It's just you and me, Ty. You and I are the only ones that have weird. All right, let me ask you this. How many of y'all have like a unique name? Like you don't call your grandma grandma, put it that way. There we go. It's not funny though, Brian. It's legit. It's not funny. I just realized why you didn't raise your hands, because you're self-conscious. I don't have a funny name for my grandma. Okay, I am one of 17 grandchildren. On my dad's side, one of 17 grandchildren, and we were all super tight. We all lived within 5 minutes of each other, and all but four of us went to the same high school. Okay, so really tight-knit family. I'm as close with some of my cousins as you are with your brothers and sisters. But each of the little tribes in our family, so like my dad's family, my uncle's family, my aunt's family, all those various people, all had a unique name for my grandmother. Now, my grandmother's real name is Rebecca Franco. Okay, but I call her Nana. How many of y'all have a Nana? Anybody here tonight? All right, good. I have a Nana. And now my Nana is also Hispanic, okay? So that's the Hispanic side of my family, and she is like a second-generation American. And so some of my other cousins, her other grandchildren, call her Mama Grande, all right? Which in English, if you don't know, is Big Mama, all right? See, I knew I'd get a laugh out of that one. So I call her Nana, my cousins call her Mama Grande, and then ironically, the only ones of us that aren't half Hispanic, like the full Hispanics, just call her Grandma. So I don't know how that one worked out, but we've got Rebecca Franco, who is known by her grandchildren as Nana, Grandma, and Mama Grande. So I'm going to say that a lot here to just kind of, you can keep laughing, but just be aware, okay? Now, how crazy would it be, right, if my cousin Stephen, who calls my Nana Mama Grande, came to me and said, Brian, I've been thinking a lot about this lately, and I've kind of got this crazy new insight to who Nana is, to who Mama Grande is, and I think you've had it wrong all along. I know you know her as Nana, but you have to understand that, like, me knowing Rebecca Franco as Mama Grande is so much better than you knowing her as Nana, right? Like, I think you've had it wrong your whole life. Like, I know you love her, and I know you've been really, like, devout in calling her Nana from the very beginning of your life, but if you would just move into our camp and kind of convert to the way we see things, and if you could just see her as Mama Grande, thank you, Ashton, your relationship with with Rebecca Franco would get so much better. Your relationship with Mama Grande would grow like you couldn't even believe it. So now I would say, all right, so let me get this right. Okay, I've known my Nana for 26 years. I've called her Nana. I know her. I love her. She knows me. She loves me. I have no doubt about that. But you're saying I need to start calling her Mama Grande because you think you found some new level or insight of truth that I haven't understood or I haven't seen yet? And he's like, yeah, exactly. Well, how do you know that? Well, I've got this book that tells me her name's Mama Grande and not Nana. Okay, yeah, I'll really believe that. But wait a second. Why do you care anyways? I'm happy the way I'm at. Why do you got to be up in my business telling me how I need to relate to my Nana when I'm fine the way I'm at? You're coming all the way over here with all of your stuff and telling me I need to start calling her Mama Grande. I just don't believe that. I don't think you're right. Now, here's the reality. I know it's kind of a funny, silly story, but that's exactly the tension that people feel when Christians try to go and convert other people to their faith. They say, I've known God by the name of Allah. I've known God by the name of Jehovah or Yahweh my whole life. Why are you telling me his name is Jesus now? Right? Who are you to say that this book tells you that the truth you have is so much better than my truth so that you've got to come over here and try to convert me to the way that you know and love and worship God? I think the way we've got it's okay. We've been doing this for a long time, Brian, and I think we've got things down all right on our side. So what do we do with that? Okay, because here's the big idea. Let me just lay my chips out all on the table, right? Just be upfront and honest with you right now. The question is, can there really be one true religion? I believe with all my heart that when you open up this Bible and you read it from front to back, that the way the Bible, the scriptures answer this question is yes. And that Christianity is the one true religion because the gospel is superiorly unique, is so far different and distinct and unique than any other world religion. It demands that it be exclusive. It demands that it be exclusively true. That Christianity is one true religion because the gospel is so much more unique than any other faith, any other philosophy or world religion that we can look at. So let me just, I'm laying all my tables out on the card, my cards out on the table up front, right? Like, here's everything I've got. But how on earth could I ever get up in America where we value individualism and the individual right to worship and all this stuff so much and tell you that? Well, here's where I want to go tonight, okay? Here's where I want to take us. First of all, we're going to address this question, because I think if we really look at this question in the same light, we'll find some very interesting things in it. And then after we address the question, then we're going to see how the Bible answers it. So we're going to address this question, and then we're going to see how the Bible answers it. So if you have a Bible with you, you can turn to Philippians 2, chapter 2, verse 5. Now, we're not going to be there for a while, but just hang on to your spot. If you don't have one, the verses will be on the screen for you, or we have some out in the hallway that you can grab on your way out for free. It's our gift to you. And so let's address this question first and foremost, okay? So here's the reality. Here's what I want to talk about. Before we can even really jump into this, we need to be on the same page about what it means to be a religious person, about even this word religion means. And I think what we need to do is redefine it. So let's think about religion not in the way that religion is what those people do in those buildings over there with their sacred ancient texts, and they're kind of holier than thou, and it doesn't really make sense in my life. That's the religious people over here, and this is the secular people over here. The religious people are on the right, the secular people are on the left, right? Republicans are evangelicals, Democrats are liberals, right? And they're secularists. That's how we typically view religion in our society. But I think we need to take a different look at it. So maybe if tonight just bear with me and kind of, for sake of argument, think about religion in this light. That all I really mean by religion, all really, religion really is a person's pursuit to answer the most basic questions in life. Right? There are some very basic questions that every human being will face, regardless of what they believe, think, live, do, anything. There are some very basic questions that all of us will have to face. And religion is not what people do in a building or the book that they read. Religion is how you answer those questions. It's any person's attempt to answer the most basic questions in life. And those questions are this: where did we come from? How did we get here? Or how about this? Why is there life instead of no life? right? There's stuff here. Why is there stuff here instead of there not being stuff here? Where did we come from? Is there meaning or purpose to life? If there is meaning or purpose, what is that meaning? What is that purpose? Where are we going? How do we define right and wrong? Can we define right and wrong? Are there moral absolutes? Is there good? Is there evil? And what happens when we die? See, these are all questions that we have to answer, that we will face, and we will struggle through in our life. And the reality is, no matter how you answer those, it's not like you can scientifically prove any of it. And so religion is just any person's attempt to answer those questions, any philosophy's attempt to answer those questions. And here's the point I'm trying to help us all understand. Regardless of you're a Christian knight or if you're not, everyone in this room is a very religious person. Now, you might be thinking, but Brian, I'm kind of indifferent to all those questions. I'm more of like the agnostic. I really don't even care. For me, it's like a non-issue. It just is, we're a blip, we're done, and then we go. It just, when I think about those questions, they're non-questions because it just really doesn't matter. I am indifferent. Okay, that may be true in an official, verbal, public stance, but the bottom line is you're living your life according to how you answer these questions. See, what these questions do is they force us to choose a path. When we ask where did we come from or what is the purpose of meaning in life, if there is a purpose or there is a meaning, it forces us to choose a path the way we live. And so none of us can be indifferent when it comes to these things. None of us can be irreligious or be non-religious because we all must answer these questions. And even though we can't sit down on a piece of paper and say, here's my answer to 1, 2, 3, and 4, we answer them with the way we live our life. And so tonight we are all very, very religious people. And that doesn't mean that we all here are holy or perfect or we don't do all the things that you heard not to do in youth group, like don't drink, don't smoke, don't have. Oh, there you go. Y'all were awake during those youth group messages, right? It's like, yeah, but just because the girl next to me was really cute. Anyways, religion isn't the pursuit of a lifestyle per se. It's how we answer the most basic questions in life. And all of us are very religious people. So, if all of us are very religious people and you can't scientifically prove any of those questions, how we answer them, then the conclusion I come to is that all of us at some level take a leap of faith, right? Because here's what happens. Sometimes we can get in our minds that, you know, I engage religion, I think about it, but I am more of the rational mind, right? I'm more of the free thinker, the skeptic. I stand back from everything and I evaluate, but I never step in and participate. I am back here, they are in there, and I can process through it all and think about it all, but I never really engage the religious dialogue. No, the reality is it's all around your life. You can't unengage it because you're living your life according to how you answer these questions. So we all are very religious people. Now, the surprising thing about this, so we've defined, what do we mean by religion? There can't be one true way of answering these questions. Now, the interesting thing in that is that no matter how you answer those questions, whether it's the purpose of life is for me to be happy or the purpose of life is for me to worship and give glory to God, regardless of how you answer those questions, what we will find is that you always, always answer them in a very exclusive way. So, right, because this is where the rubber hits the road. Our problem isn't that we're all religious people. Our problem that we have is when you tell me how I need to start living my life. Right? Our problem is when you tell me that the faith I have is inferior to the faith that you have. But what we'll find and what I want to look at next is that the way we answer those questions, that is inherent to all of us. All of us make exclusive faith claims when we answer those questions. Our religious leanings are all exclusive. So let me show you what I mean. Let me give you a few examples real quick. First of all, let's talk about this idea of religious pluralism. Okay, religious pluralism means that all religions are equal. That the answer to this question is no. There's not one true religion because they're all equally true. Okay, one of my favorite authors, Tim Keller, and who a lot of this is based on, he says this. It is no more narrow to claim that one religion is right than to claim that one way to think about all religions is right. Okay, you see what he's saying there? He's saying, okay, if you're a religious pluralist, saying all religions are equal, and if you think that your religion is superior to other people's religion, you are narrow-minded. You are a bigot. You have a small mind. What you're saying is the one way that I view all religions is superior to the way that you view your religion. So in effect, I am making an exclusive faith claim that now trumps your inferior faith claim. Okay, all of the right people see all religions are equal, and everyone else on the outside think theirs is superior. So I am excluding all of you from my group of people who see all religions to be true. So even in that statement, it's an exclusive faith claim. The same thing happens with tolerance. How many times do you feel like you hear this word in the news now? So-and-so intolerant. So-and-so needs to be more tolerant. Tolerant, tolerant, tolerant. So here's the interesting thing, okay? The idea of tolerance implies exclusivity, right? You know what, as a nation, people were not intolerant to? Smokers, right? We don't like smokers. How many of y'all in the last week walked by someone who was smoking a cigarette and you did this? Ugh, gosh. No one, okay, a couple honest, it's church. We can be honest, right? We can be honest in church. See, as much as we love tolerance in our society, we are very intolerant to smokers. And I, for one, am starting to change that. I'm starting a campaign to free smokers. You know, you have a cigarette, light up right now, right? I'm kidding. It's a joke. Some of y'all are like, oh gosh, I've got to change churches now. Gosh, Brian, why'd you go there? Anyways, don't tell my boss I told you to light up a cigarette, okay? Please don't tell him that. So here's what's said in the tolerant, because tolerance, even though it says don't be exclusive, don't say you're superior, all people are equal. What it says is this: our group of people over here are tolerant, and you are not. If you condemn X or Y lifestyle, you are intolerant, we are intolerant. And so when I say I value tolerance as one of the highest moral values in our society, I am excluding all of those who are intolerant. Let's just talk about the basic one, right? The most basic one. Is there a difference between good and evil? How many of you have ever been to the Grand Canyon before? Anyone ever been to the Grand Canyon? Okay. You know what I've been there once. And I've talked to a lot of people who have gone. You know what I've never heard about someone who either went to the Grand Canyon or was there? Then be like, it was all right. Right? Like, have y'all ever, has anyone, and if you have, just don't raise your hand because you're going to totally ruin this illustration. Have you ever heard anyone who's been to the Grand Canyon be like, it wasn't really worth the trip? No, because when you go, you are awestruck by its beauty. You look at that and you say, that is incredible. And every person who ever sees it is in awe of how great it is. And what we see in that moment is that is good. I can't necessarily define good anywhere else in my life, but when I look at that scene, that incredible canyon, I realize this is good. And what we're saying is we are making a definite exclusive faith claim. We're saying this is good, that tree over there by it is not as good. Or let me bring it a little more home, it's a little more serious, but how many of you, when you hear about in the news that a young woman was raped on a college campus, there's immediate moral outrage in your heart, and you feel sick and disgusted, and you feel so bad for her, and you're so angry at the person who committed the crime? Right? You know what is a universal reality? Nowhere you go is rape honored. Nowhere is it appreciated. Nowhere is it respectable. Nowhere is it morally valued. And what we do in that moment where I might verbally say, hey, morality is relative. You've got to see the right in your own eyes. You've got to pursue that however you see it true to be true. You've got to follow your heart for what you find to be moral. But in my heart, when I hear about things like molestation and abuse and rape, I know that is wrong. And in your heart, you're making an exclusive faith claim. Here's what I'm trying to show you tonight. When we look at this question, we have to understand two things. All of us are religious people. All of us take a leap of faith at some point in our life when we seek to answer the most fundamental questions of life. And when we take that leap of faith, what we will find more often than not is that they are very exclusive claims. So let me ask you this, especially tonight, if you're here and you say, I'm not a Christian, I'm more of a skeptic. Let me ask you this. What is different about making an exclusive faith claim about morality or tolerance that's a leap of faith? How is that so much different than the crazy religious beliefs these people have in a wacky church? I don't think they are. If you really boil it down, what these people are saying they believe from the Bible is not so much different than what we say we believe about tolerance. Because at the end of the day, we're all taking a leap of faith, And we're all saying, this is exclusive. You're either in, you're out. You're either right, you're wrong. You're either tolerant, you're intolerant. You either see good or you don't see good. You either see bad or you don't see bad. And so let's not pretend tonight that Christianity is somehow oppressive or wrong or evil for making an exclusive faith claim. Because just like the Bible says that Christianity is exclusive and is superior, we all do this in our lives all the time. Now, here's the bottom line, which I want you to wrap your mind around, okay? I really want you to get. The issue isn't whether or not you're tolerant. The issue isn't whether or not you are going to be open with people and you're going to accept people for who they are and you're not going to be pushy. The bottom line is you will make an exclusive faith claim at some point in your life. At some point in your life, you're going to draw the line and you're going to say, that person's wrong, I am right. What I am saying tonight is evaluate why you believe what you believe. All of us are religious people. All of us take leaps of faith. There's no person in here who's more rational than another. Maybe if you watch The Bachelor, but we'll leave that for another time or place, okay? But at the end of the day, we all take a leap of faith. We all make faith claims that are very exclusive. And so if none of us are any different, the challenge for us today is, why do we believe what we believe? Let's not be scared. Let's not dig in. Or maybe let's not just write Christianity off as antiquated and dumb and irrational, and it worked for those people at that time, but today we really don't need it. Let's not write Christianity off. Let's realize we have a lot more beliefs that are similar to that than we first thought. And let's really dig in and see why we believe what we believe. So now that we've addressed the question, let me show you how the Bible answers it. And here's, again, what I'm going to do. I could give you a litany of reasons why I believe Christianity is true. Again, there's been books upon books upon books written about it. But tonight, I want to give you what I think is one of the most powerful truths for why I personally believe that Christianity is true. So again, what's the big idea? I laid all my chips out on the table, all my cards on the table. That Christianity is the one true religion because the gospel is a superior, distinctive claim. It is superiorly, I don't think that's a word, but it makes sense, unique in our world. So let's go back to Philippians chapter 2 and let's read through this. Chapter 2, verse 5. It says this. This is the Apostle Paul, and he's explaining the gospel. And when I say the gospel, especially if you're new to Christianity, what I mean is the gospel is the essence of what it means to be a Christian. It's the most basic beliefs and the driving beliefs and the center of what it means to be a follower of Christ. So when we say this is the gospel, we mean this is what it means to be Christian. This is the doctrine, the center doctrinal piece of Christianity. And in these verses, the Apostle Paul lays it out beautifully. The Apostle Paul knew Jesus himself. He had a physical encounter with him when Jesus came and he saved him, he converted him, and then he spent time with him. And so the Apostle Paul knew Jesus. He had talked with Jesus, and he tells us what the central piece of his teachings were in these verses. And it says this, "Have this mind among yourselves, which is yours in Christ Jesus." So he tells the church, this was the mind of Christ, you need to have it. Verse 6, who? Talking about Jesus. Jesus was in the form of God, but did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped. So let's stop there. He says, Jesus Christ is God. He makes it very clear. Though he was in the form of God, that means in very essence, Jesus was not just another good teacher. He wasn't a good man. He wasn't a philosopher. He wasn't just a prophet. He was God in flesh, right? Because what we try to do is we try to take the gospel and water it down and say, Jesus was a good guy. He said a lot of good things, but he's not really God. But right here, he says, though he was in the form of God, the very essence and nature of God, Jesus Christ, when he walked this world, he was God incarnate, God in flesh. That is a unique claim. That is a phenomenally unique claim. It is distinct from all other world religions, all other philosophies, that God himself came down to earth in Jesus, and he walked among us, and he served, and he did miracles, and he loved, and he taught. And then this is what happens. Though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself by taking the form of a servant. So he says, as God, he released his rights and privileges to be God, and he became a human. He didn't cease to be God, but to his divinity, he added on the human nature. And the God-man walked on the earth. And it says this, verse 7, being born in the likeness of men. Verse 8, and being found in human form. So now God is found in human form, coming down to the earth, the greatest missionary effort ever to convert all of us to know God, to bring us in relationship with God the Father. He is found in human form. Verse 8, it says, he humbled himself even more by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. So let's think about this for a moment. So the gospel, the essence of Christianity, is that God comes to our earth. He comes to us. He walks among us. He teaches us. He loves us. He serves us. And then he dies the most excruciating death on the cross. And what Paul writes elsewhere is on that cross, it wasn't just a good man dying, again, because he's God. There's something different going on here. But that in that moment, Jesus Christ took our place. So the centerpiece of Christianity is the cross. And the cross is this, that on the cross, Jesus took the very worst of me, so by faith, I can receive the very best of him. All of the blessings he deserved for living a perfect and holy life, he gives to me, and all the cursings that I deserve for living a broken and sinful life, he takes onto himself. And by faith, when I see that Christ died in my place, received the punishment I deserve because of the brokenness in my life, and if we're all honest with ourselves, we know we are broken people. He took the punishment I deserve so that I can, by faith, receive the gift of being the Son of God, being a Son of God. So by faith, I can receive his perfection, his holiness, his righteousness. So now I am no longer sinful Brian, no longer liar, angry, filled with pride Brian. I am a son of God. I am holy and righteous. And when God looks to me, he sees the perfection of his son, and he loves me exactly like he loves his son, Jesus. And so on the cross, the centerpiece of Christianity, what is so unique is there's nothing that I did, right? I didn't do anything for that. Jesus himself did the work. He lived the perfect life. He died the terrible death. It was for me in my place, but I had nothing to do with it. I didn't accomplish it. I didn't motivate him on. I wasn't standing there saying, go, Jesus, die for my sins. In fact, if I would have been there, I would have been mocking him and scorning him like all the others were. And then it says this. The point of even death on the cross. Therefore, God has highly exalted him and bestowed on him the name that is above every name. So at the name of Jesus, every knee should bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God the Father. It says, therefore, God has highly exalted him. And what that means is that when Jesus died on the cross, they took him down from the cross and put him in a tomb. They buried him, but he didn't remain buried because though he was in the earth, God physically and literally exalted him, raised him back to life, showing that he conquered my sin, he conquered my death, and now offers me new life through his resurrection, offers me forgiveness of sins through his resurrection, offers me power to live this life through his resurrection, and God took him out of the grave and exalted him to the highest position in all of existence. See, here's the gospel. The gospel is Jesus came down from heaven as God to walk among us. He suffered, he bled, and died the most atrocious death that was ever been died. The sin of humanity was placed on him, and he literally went to the lowest low that anyone could ever go. And as he went to the lowest low that anyone could ever go, he has now been exalted to the highest high that anyone could go. There is no higher place of authority than Jesus Christ. There's no higher place of glory and honor and respect and worship than Jesus Christ. Do you see that this is a distinct religious view? This is a unique way of looking at the most basic answers or questions to life. See, because what happens in our world, most religious philosophies and most world religions say this, that we are all at the base of an incredibly large mountain and God is at the top. And the human nature and the human condition and mission is to try to climb that mountain to see and be where God is at. And so we, even though there's a multitude of people around the base, even though they all go their different paths, they're all working their way to the top. God is at the top, we are at the bottom. So if you go this path and I go that path, it's okay because we're all going to the top. That's what we're trying to do. And the top is God. It's ultimate reality. It's whatever I want heaven to be. It's whatever purpose or meaning I find for my life. So you don't judge me for taking this path when I'm okay with this path. You go your path, I'll go mine. But what the gospel says, what Christianity says, is none of us could ever climb that mountain. It was too high, too large, too treacherous, and it was impossible because we are broken people to climb that mountain to where God is. So instead, God himself comes down to us. And if God comes down to us, we no longer have the luxury of saying, take your own path. Because number one, even if you took your own path, you wouldn't make it. And God knew that, so he made a path to us. He came down to where we're at. Think about this for a moment. Don't lose this. God, in the greatest, most darkest moment of your life, meets you right where you're at in the gospel. In your greatest moment of suffering, in your greatest moment of temptation and struggle and sin, he says, I know you can't make it up. I know you're dying under the weight of this life. I am going to go down to you. I'm going to humble myself. I am going to die. I'm going to be buried in a grave. And when I resurrect and am exalted all the way up to the top, I will bring you with me and you will be with me for eternity. That's the gospel. And this is what I believe about the gospel. It is so unique. It is so distinct when we evaluate that compared to other philosophies and world religions that it must be exclusive. Because he came to us. We don't go to him. Because here's the bottom line. Most people answer these fundamental questions by saying, be a better version of yourself. Most people's religion or ideologies or philosophy says, try hard, do your best, serve others, be nice, be an improved version of yourself and always try to be better and things will work out in the end. That's most people's answers to the most basic questions in life. Christianity says, you can't be a better version of yourself. But God, in his love and his grace, comes to us. Grace, that's the word. Grace is the word that distinguishes Christianity from everything else. It's what makes it exclusive. Because God unconditionally loved us. God, though we didn't deserve it, loved us. God put his favor on us by coming down to us. So today, the offer and the invitation of the gospel is this, is when you look to the cross, if on the cross you see Jesus dying for your sins, put your faith in that. Put your hope in that. Center your life on that. Trust in that. Rest in that. And as you do that, as you put your faith in that, he now makes you new. He awakens your heart. He shows you what it is to love. He shows you the way to him. So where are you at tonight? Tonight, if you're a skeptic and you say, I'm not a Christian, I'm kind of new, I just came, even though I really didn't want to, but this guy or this girl just kept bugging me, so I came. I'm so glad you're here. I'm not trying to make a hard sell on you, like, let's do a 20-minute time where you're going to feel really weird if you don't come forward. I'm not about that. But what I am about is this. Evaluate why you think the way you think. Be honest with yourself. Is there a little more faith in my mind, in my heart, than I ever thought there was? And if this guy is right, that even I make exclusive truth claims, what's so different about my faith claims that are exclusive than Christianity's? And how does Christianity's faith claim match up to mine? And maybe, just maybe, I need to take a closer look at that whole Bible Christianity church thing that I've, because I've been kind of writing it off for a while. Maybe I just need to take a closer look than I originally thought. Tonight, maybe you view yourself as a pretty religious person. You don't come to church all the time, but you were baptized as a baby, or you went through confirmation classes, or maybe you grew up going to Awanas and all this stuff. And maybe you're, hey, I'm not in church every week, but I'm a good person. I've got a little bit of Jesus, and I'm a good person. I know a little bit about the Bible, and I'm all right. The exclusive faith claim of the gospel is that you're not okay. You're not good enough. Just because you were baptized doesn't mean that gets you to the top of the mountain. Just because you went through confirmation classes doesn't mean you climbed the mountain. No, Jesus came to you. It's not about the religious stuff you do. It's not about going to church. It's about, do you love Jesus Christ? Do you trust in his death and his resurrection? Is he your hope? Is he the center of everything in your life? Is he how you define all aspects of your life? And if the answer is no, something's wrong. You can't be religious enough to figure this thing out. You can't be good enough to figure this thing out. He came to you. Humble yourself before him and rest in what he's done. And tonight, if you're a believer, you say, Brian, I'm a Christian, I'm a follower of Jesus, and I'm a believer. What doubts do you have, and are you running from them? You've got to face them. I know it's scary. I know there's that book that you've always wanted to read, but you never did because you're scared of what it might affect your faith. But I'm telling you, if you don't face them now, they will come out of the closet. And at that time, when they come out, it's going to be even harder to deal with. Embrace your doubt. Embrace your struggle. And through prayer and study and hard work and great conversations, come out stronger on the other side. So what I want to do now is I want to give you an opportunity to respond. And all this is if you feel compelled, like God was maybe moving in your heart, or if you have more questions, or if there's anything that you even want to talk about, or maybe you just have something you want someone to pray for you about, this is your opportunity to do that. It's up to you. If you want to respond, respond. If you don't, you can stay in your seat. I just ask that if you're compelled to respond, don't ignore it. Don't waste that opportunity for something to be worked in your life in this faith journey. Let me pray for you, okay?
Thanks for listening to the Vertical Access Podcast. If you'd like to know more about VA, check out highstreet.org.